Kroger.com/sock drive.
I got an email from Donald Trump. As you know, 2 years ago, I kicked $5 into his campaign to get on his fundraising list and his email list. And I mean, this is incredible. He says, dear Fred Flintstone, that's me. Democrats are trying to overturn our Republican victories in Florida. First, they started coming up with ballots out of thin air. They fought to include votes from people who are not even United States citizens. Now, keep in mind, no Democrat ever did this. This is a blatant lie being told to us by the President of the United States. In an email, it's probably going to 10 or 20 million people. And then he goes on, and now that this is actually from last week, and now that the recount is officially underway, an army of liberal lawyers is invading, we need our own lawyers, please contribute $250, contribute $100, contribute $50, begging for money. It's signed Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, lying about what's going on. The whole thing to me is just absolutely breathtaking. So, anyhow, Lamar Waldron is with us. And today marks the 55th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And Trump said that he was going to release all these assassination files. And yet, he didn't. So I wanted to bring us up to date on what's going on with the JFK assassination. Starting 30 years ago this month, Lamar and I began a collaboration that turned out two huge books. The vast majority of the work being done by Lamar. Ultimate Sacrifice is the first, Legacy of Secrecy the second, and then Lamar went on and wrote a third book, his most recent, which is in print right now, easily found, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. Lamar, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you again, Tom. It's hard to believe it's been 30 years, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
This is the Tom Hartman Show, and Rob is out today, so we're going to do a little bit of Tom Hartman for the next hour. So listen up.
Went through to track down Harry and Ricky Ruiz Williams, who really cracked open the whole secret plot, with Castro and all this stuff that led to not just the assassination, but the successful cover-up of it. But we also had a guy who was very, very close to Bobby Kennedy. And today we're going to talk about who he was for the very first time. We haven't named him in any of the books. And what we learned from him. Also, Gary Hart, Brett Kavanaugh, and Mitch McConnell have a role to play here. So, but Lamar, what did Trump do about the JFK assassination files?
Okay, so you and a lot of your listeners might remember that last year at this time, actually a few weeks before the anniversary last year, a year ago, all the JFK files were supposed to be released. Congress had passed the law back in the early 90s, unanimously passed it. We can't imagine that today, right? And this was in the wake of the Oliver Stone JFK film, and it was to release all of the JFK assassination files. Because people thought, well, there could be hundreds of files left, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, basically, Congress passed that law, and there was a commission appointed, distinguished historians and a judge, everybody who was supposed to look at the files. And well, they released 4.5 million files. But a lot of the agencies, the CIA and the FBI, held back their files till that commission was basically set to go out of business and dump them at the last minute. So NBC News said when that commission ended around 1997, 1998, a million CIA files alone remained to be released. So there were a lot of files left to be released. The ultimate deadline Congress had set was last October of 2017. So, and only the president could, he would have the final judgment if a few documents had to be kept secret for personal reasons or national security or something, after all those years, the president could do that. Well, so worldwide attention was focused on this. I was sent to Washington by Japanese television to film a document, to be there when all these files were finally released. And I kept telling them, you're going to be disappointed because they're not going to all get released. A lot of files will be released, you know, but the main files, a lot of those millions, they're not going to be released because they're not even on the list to be released. So sure enough, Trump's appointees waited until like the last day. I mean, the last day, went to him and said, look, we can't release all of our files. That's what the FBI told him, CIA, other agencies. So he said, okay, look, we're going to give it till April. Okay. And then the files are all going to get released. So most people think all the files got released. They didn't. Last April, a bunch of files got released. Some we already had parts of. Some were released with almost completely blacked out pages. But there were hundreds of files that weren't released that were on the official list. But as you and I have talked about, and your listeners who've heard me speak before know, all the most official files about the attempts to kill JFK in Tampa 4 days before Dallas, the government's plans for what to do if JFK was assassinated, that Robert Kennedy spearheaded making those plans starting 2 months before that, all those, no, those aren't even on the list to get released. And so what Trump did was kick it down the road another 3.5 years and said, well, you know, in October of 2021, the files that haven't been released yet, we'll look at them again and maybe they'll be released. You know, Trump, with a lot of luck, won't even be president in October of 2021. So the bottom line is the archives admit 520 documents remain withheld completely in full. But, you know, all of the most secret files, including operations that we're going to talk about today that are our own deep throat of, you know, what the, I think he's, there are only two more confidential sources left after we identified this gentleman today for the very first time. You know, they told us about these. We found bits and pieces of the documents. So we know they exist. We know thousands of other documents exist, but they aren't even on the list. They aren't even on that 520 item list. So that's where things stand, which is not a great situation if you and I ever want to see those files.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty amazing. And Brett Kavanaugh involved in all this stuff. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to our informant, our deep throat, and a whole bunch of other stuff having to do with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The anniversary is the day after tomorrow. Or is it tomorrow?
It's tomorrow.
Thanks.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back. It's the 55th anniversary, or will be tomorrow, of the assassination of President John Kennedy. And we're talking with Lamar Waldron about this. And welcome back. So, Lamar, tell me about Brett Kavanaugh.
Well, it was so ironic. The very day that Trump nominated Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, he was part of a ruling, and you probably know a little bit more about D.C. courts than I do, but he was on the appeals court.
Yeah, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
Exactly. And they had been dealing with a particular case for several years. And on the very day that Trump nominated him, his final ruling in that case was released. And it's the most ridiculous case you've ever heard of. And it's going to take a little explanation, but if you bear with me, I promise you and your listeners it's all worth it.
We have 2.5 minutes to the break.
So basically, back in the late 70s, Congress was doing another investigation of JFK's murder. And this was a big investigation, the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And the CIA was supposed to help them out, right? This is under Jimmy Carter. And Stansfield Turner, CIA director. And so they didn't have anything to hide. So they're like, yeah, CIA, cooperate. So the House Select Committee said, look, we need to know which CIA agent was running a group of Cubans that Oswald had well-documented contact with a few months before the assassination in New Orleans. Can you give us a CIA agent to help us find that CIA supervisor? Okay. And so the CIA said, sure, we'll send a guy to help you find this guy that you desperately need to talk to. Well, they never found the FBI supervisor because the agent the CIA sent them to help them find the FBI supervisor was the agent that had run that operation. And we need to give credit to a guy named Jefferson Morley, who in the 90s was a reporter for the Washington Post. He tracked that down. He said, my God, you know, the CIA basically just deceived Congress.
So this is Fox meet Hen House? Is that the routine here?
Exactly, exactly. So Jefferson Morley did a lot of work exposing this, filed lawsuits, everything like that. He's not with the Post anymore. And basically, this Freedom of Information lawsuit went to that circuit where Kavanaugh was, okay? Mm-hmm. So first, Morley was able to get some of the files out of them, but they just withheld lots more, and the whole question of obstruction of justice was just ignored by Kavanaugh. On the Supreme, I mean, it's just like, okay, they obstruct your justice? No, that's fine. We won't even worry about that. So then, whenever a private citizen like you or I or Morley goes after files and you get anything, you get some of them, the government's supposed to pay your expenses and the expenses of your Freedom of Information attorney. So that was the most recent part. The CIA said, sure, we were hiding some files. We're keeping, of course, most of them. But, yeah, we shouldn't have to pay a dime, even though you caught us cheating and we have committed obstruction of justice, which they didn't admit. And so that was the ruling that Kavanaugh put down the day he was nominated to the Supreme Court, was that, yeah, the CIA, yes, so what if they committed obstruction of justice? So what if they hid and are still hiding files from Congress and the American public? It doesn't matter. Morley does not get his expenses paid. I don't know if Morley is appealing that decision. If he can appeal, I sure hope so. But, wow. I mean that tells you a lot about Brett Kavanaugh, that obstruction of justice to him wasn't even a factor.
That's amazing. Lamar Waldron is with us. His most recent book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. He also wrote Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy with a little help from me. And we'll be back with our conversation with Lamar Waldron in just a moment. By the way, the website, what's your website?
No, Lamar. The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination.com.
Thank you. We'll be right back. You know, here at the Tom Hartman Program, this program at patreon.com/Tom Hartman, T-H-O-M, Hartman with two N's. You're helping our team at the Tom Hartman Program to air our show for free on nonprofit radio and cable stations. And what you get for that is supporter-only videos from me. You can watch the entire show, all 3 hours of our program, and past shows all 3 hours, anytime you want, just by becoming a member. For more information, patreon.com/Tom Hartman. And thank you for supporting our program. One of our special videos on patreon.com/Tom Hartman, T-H-O-M-H-A-R-T-M-A-N-N, is titled, Could Civilization Be Extinct by 2026? You can only see this video by becoming a member of Patreon, which supports us in being on nonprofit radio and TV. So please help support our program. You'll also be able to watch our entire show 24/7 just by becoming a member at patreon.com/Tom Hartman. Thank you again for supporting our program. That's patreon.com/Tom Hartman. Welcome back. Lamar Waldron is with us, the author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, as well as the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, two books that I played a role in, and my name is on the cover. And Lamar, we were just talking about how Brett Kavanaugh's last ruling when he was on the D.C. Circuit, the day that Trump nominated him for the U.S. Supreme Court, or appointed, I guess, is the whatever the word is, that his last ruling was to say that to a lawyer who had filed a FOIA or a reporter who had filed a FOIA claim, a Freedom of Information Act claim with the CIA asking for Kennedy records, and the CIA lied to him and to Congress and hid things and obstructed justice. And Brett Kavanaugh basically said, that's okay with me. Do I have that right?
And not only that's okay with me, but yeah, the CIA, like the law says, unlike the law says, doesn't even have to pay your expenses.
Yeah. Just spent all so, the time. So Kavanaugh's now on the Supreme Court. If a JFK case winds up in front of them, do you expect him to recuse himself? I mean, you know.
Of course not. Of course not. He would probably tell the other justices, "Oh, I know all about this." No, he would probably take the lead on it because he has experience with years of this.
You mean covering up CIA files about the Kennedy assassination?
Right. You know.
Seriously, so, on the D.C. Circuit, this is not the only time he's done that.
Right. Well, he had this. There have been a lot of rulings on this particular case, at least two major ones, including that one that came out that he was nominated. So he has experience there. It's just one more reason Kavanaugh needs to be forced to resign. You know, we know Mitch McConnell's never going to let him be impeached the way that Anthony Scalia should have been impeached. And sometime, we don't really have time today, I hope progressives out there will look at the same techniques that were used to force the resignation of Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas.
Right.
Because they can be applied to get Kavanaugh to resign. But let's get back to Mitch McConnell.
Well, it could also be applied theoretically to get Thomas to resign. But anyway, that's
He's probably even closer. That's a great point.
That's another fantasy.
Because the bottom line is, even with the Democrats in control of the House, even when the Democrats hold, I hope, high-profile hearings about the still-withheld JFK files, I mean, what a great thing. I mean, who is against releasing those files? Not many people. I mean, Brett Kavanaugh, but, you know, and Mitch McConnell. But they're never going to be able to pass a law to do anything because Mitch McConnell, people don't realize, he started his career working for the Warren Commission.
The Warren Commission that was designed to functionally cover up who killed Kennedy, because at the time LBJ was worried that it was Fidel Castro, and if that came out, it would cause World War III if he had to react to that. And that's why you see Warren walking out of that meeting with Lyndon Johnson, where he was told, "You're going to cover this thing up," with tears streaming down his face.
Right,
do I have that right?
I thought it was tens of millions of people could die if it came out that Castro had any role in it. He didn't. And even Bobby Kennedy's people, they pushed for the Warren Commission because they didn't want Hoover being the only person. So the Warren Commission, garbage in, garbage out, the least informed of five official government committees to investigate the assassination, and Mitch McConnell was the intern for one of the Warren commissioners, Sherman Cooper. So he cut his teeth on that. He obviously has a vested interest. So last year, when Senator Chuck Grassley, whom we know from the recent Kavanaugh hearings, and who on occasion has been semi-reasonable, certainly not about Kavanaugh, but Grassley was like, "Yeah, we need all the JFK files released. Let's do something." But his efforts in the Senate went nowhere because Mitch McConnell has no interest in doing anything that's going to tarnish the reputation of the Warren Commission.
So, which he was on. Amazing. Or which he was a part. He worked on
when he was an intern for one of the Warren commissioners from Kentucky.
Right.
So nothing's going to happen in the Senate. Anything that's going to happen to get these files has to happen in the House, and it's happened before.
Real quickly, what should the House be doing?
They need to hold high-profile hearings to say, look, all the most important assassination files are not even on the list that might be released in 2021. Why is that? Get the directors of the FBI, CIA, Secret Service, Naval Intelligence, they're all the main people, to come up and testify under oath. The people running those agencies, they don't know anything, but they're enough tenured professors, who know this stuff, who could advise that committee. We'd certainly be happy to. And again, what are the Republicans in the House going to do? Are they going to say, no, we shouldn't release all? I mean, it's one of those things that actually should have bipartisan support, but that's only going to happen if they do those hearings. And I know they've got a lot on their plate, I'm not saying this should be the first thing on their plate, but they need to do that because the House Select Committee in the late 70s, they actually, the one that the CIA, did the bait and switch on with that CIA operative, the supervisor, they actually uncovered a lot of stuff. They actually concluded JFK was killed by a conspiracy. They identified these two mobsters, Carlos Marcello of Louisiana and Texas, Fino Trafficante of Tampa, as having the motive, means, and opportunity. So, and they weren't even the first congressional investigation. The first congressional investigation was before that, and you may have heard of the Senate Church Committee.
Right, and we have just 1 minute to the break. Gary Hart was part of that.
He was a big part of that, not just on the main Church Committee to look into CIA abuses and assassination plots, but he and, I believe his name was Schweiker, they had a JFK assassination subcommittee, so they specifically looked into the JFK assassination. Gary Hart himself, on this record source for us, by the way, actually went to Europe trying to meet a particular CIA assassin recruiter by the name of, with the code name of QJ Wynn. And so you know, Hart was really digging into this, and he'd really stumbled on something, because if people look in any of our books, but especially Ultimate Sacrifice, the first one, there were I think 24 parallels between the guy Hart was looking for and someone who was definitely in Dallas involved with JFK's assassination.
Remarkable. Okay, after the break, Lamar and I are going to really do a deep dive here into the JFK assassination, what happened 55 years ago in Dallas, and reveal our very own deep throat, one of our most confidential sources who is very, very close to Bobby Kennedy and gave us a lot of inside information.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
This hour, we're doing a deep dive into the JFK assassination. Stick around. It's going to get fascinating. Book today is Can We All Be Feminists? It's a collection of essays edited by Jane Eric Udori. This first essay is from Charlotte Shane. It's called No Wave Feminism. If you feel like feminism is failing you, you're not alone. I sometimes have the impression that I'm as thoroughly feminist as I am thoroughly human. The feminism is as intrinsic to my contribution to my constitution as my skeleton is to my body. But in my 35 years, I've struggled with or outright rejected feminism on several occasions. First, as an ignorant adolescent, what do women need feminism for if they already got the vote? Then, as a sex worker who saw how regularly and even gleefully feminists stoked the public's long-standing antipathy toward professional asexual women. And now again, as someone moving even further into the far left, who cannot abide the forms of feminism that embrace and are complicit with the worst aspects of liberalism. The more I learn about the intersecting oppressive forces that continue to shape the Western world, colonialism, patriarchy, capitalism, xenophobia, and racism, and the network of cruel social machinery to which these systems give rise, incarceration, crippling debt, disenfranchisement, deportation, and so on, the less sense it makes to use gender as the primary lens through which to regard human-engineered suffering. Feminism doesn't feel like the sharpest weapon to wield against white supremacy or border policing, for instance, or even the best tool with which to approach basic civic concerns like vibrant schools. That's not because those issues don't impact women. Obviously, they directly and indirectly impact many. But they don't necessarily impact women more or in dramatically different ways than they do men. In other words, the most significant challenges these issues present aren't tethered to one's sex. And so prioritizing gender above other aspects of identity limits one's realm of ethical responses. Here's an example. American prisons often keep female prisoners shackled while they give birth. There are variations on the theme. Some women are shackled during labor. Some are unshackled, but then shackled again almost immediately afterward. And almost all are shackled while heavily pregnant. There's some variation of what shackling entails, too. It can mean being cuffed at the wrists or at the ankles or both, or cuffed to a hospital bed or chained at the waist. Articulating these details makes the sadism even starker. A class action federal lawsuit in 2017 alleged more than 40 women at the Milwaukee County Jail suffered this horror. It was preceded by lawsuits in 2014 and 2016 against that same jail for similar practice. But the appalling practice is hardly confined to one city or one state. In 2015, New York prisons were found to be shackling prisoners in labor in spite of a state law that made it illegal to do so. And according to a 2016 report by the Prison Birth Project and Prisoners Legal Services of Massachusetts, jails and prisons in Massachusetts were guilty of similar violations. Most feminists probably agree that this is a feminist issue. The topic accordingly receives coverage on feminist websites and sometimes in women's magazines. But does a feminist obligation to attend to the rights of the imprisoned extend only as far as pregnancy and labor? Or is it a feminist issue when a non-pregnant woman is shackled? Or when she is caged for years and exploited for her labor, denied face-to-face visits from loved ones, held captive in a compound in the name of, quote, justice? If the answer to these questions is yes, then it is also a feminist issue. Then is it also a feminist issue when men are shackled during various health emergencies? Seizures, say. In 2014, a male inmate in Colorado died after undergoing several seizures while in restraints and receiving no medical treatment. Is it a feminist issue when incarcerated men are denied the right to visit with family or exploited for their labor? Is it a feminist issue when so many men are raped while in prison? Or does feminism's responsibility begin and end with gender-based mistreatment? The feminists hired by prominent media outlets often advocate for measures that would result in higher levels of incarceration. They write op-eds in favor of further criminalization around sex work and call for longer prison sentences for men convicted of assault, which we've known for decades is not necessarily synonymous with men who committed the crime. They also disturbingly relish the theater of sentencing like that enacted by Judge Rosemary Aquilina, who told serial sexual abuser Larry Nassar that if she could, she would allow some or many people to do to him what he did to others. So sexual violation is an atrocity unless it happens to the right person. They capitalize on women's justified fear and anger around mistreatment by men to shore up the status quo, to suggest that our current problems are not the result of fundamentally unjust institutions, but rather institutions that are only incidentally sexist. That means that those same institutions could become less so with the right adjustments, like more draconian sentencing for crimes against women, or more female judges. But the prison system is racist and brutal by design, not by accident or mismanagement, just as the court system regularly fails the most vulnerable because it was built to protect the powerful. The challenge of the 21st century is not to demand equal opportunity to participate in the machinery of oppression, revolutionary thinker Angela Davis has written. Rather, it is to identify and dismantle those structures. Yet leveraging our existing legal system for criminalization remains the go-to strategy for most feminists when it comes to dealing with objectionable behavior. The book, Can We All Be Feminists?
Want to connect to the show online? You can find the Tom Hartman Program on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Lamar Waldron on the line with us, and we've been talking about the Kennedy assassination, Lamar's most recent book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. He and I wrote two other books on the subject, Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, and you can find all of those, you know, at your normal place. So, Lamar, you know, Gary Hart, we started talking about this. We, you know, you were talking about QJ Wynn, and I went to Paris trying to track down Victor Mertz, and
exactly right. And people should know that what Hart was onto was a guy by the name of Michael Victor Mertz, who was an assassin, a very famous assassin.
I know. I felt totally spooked trying to track this guy around Paris, as you well remember.
I've always told you,
I was scared to death.
Well, and I hate to say this, Tom, but because I probably didn't emphasize that enough back then, but yeah, you should have been, because he helped to invent what we know today as the French Connection, that Santo Trafficante and others used to get all that heroin. In fact, you know, the technique in the French Connection movie, great movie, you know, hiding the heroin in a car, smuggling over, I'm sure, that was what Mertz did. But Mertz was also, he was high in the French mafia, deep connections with the American mafia, and he worked for French intelligence. He had been a Nazi sympathizer. When that, you know, when it looked like France was going to lose the war, he picked up a machine gun and machine gunned a bistro full of Nazis. So he wound up, you know, being decorated in World War II. But by the early 60s, he had helped prevent one of the many assassination attempts against Charles de Gaulle. So he had ties with French intelligence. Anything he wanted, you know, in terms of the French mafia or the American mafia, he could get. And get this, we actually have the document that says Michael Victor Mertz was deported from Dallas,
right,
you know, within 24 hours of JFK's murder. You know,
right.
So he was there. He was part of it.
So do you think he was the shooter from the window?
Well, let's put it this way. He actually, there is a guy described in the window as wearing sportswear that fits Mertz's description very well. Mertz was more of a supervisor who could have certainly have fired the shot in a heartbeat if he had had to. But so he, when you need someone on the ground, he could speak perfectly unaccented English. And when his story was later told by Newsday in a Pulitzer Prize winning expose of the heroin trade, called The Heroin Trail in the early 70s, I talked to that Pulitzer Prize winning reporter years later and said, you know, nobody's got a good picture of Mertz. Do you have one? He says, oh, yeah, we've got one. We got one after the articles ran. I'll go get it out of my file. It's in the special file, you know, the one that we keep sensitive stuff in. He came back on the line, you know, about an hour later and said, it's gone. Somebody got it out of our... So bottom line is, Hart was going where the CIA didn't want him to go, under the Church Committee, not at the start, but by the end, the CIA director was George Bush. And so there were constant battles. Bush withheld a lot of information from the Church Committee. And Hart was so...
Wait a minute, George Bush was running the CIA at the time that JFK was assassinated?
No.
This was after the fact. Okay, what I thought.
Yeah, during the last half of the Church Committee, while Hart was trying to get files out of the CIA, he was constantly battling with George Bush's CIA, who just wouldn't give up the files.
Right.
Like they're keeping them today. And so, flash ahead to the mid-80s, Hart is looking at running for, you know, Bush is vice president then, and Hart even writes a novel that includes thinly veiled portraits of a CIA director like Bush and QJ Wynn, and basically, you know, says, yeah, JFK was killed by a conspiracy, but the CIA is hiding a lot of stuff, as they were. And so when Hart, you know, ran for president, he was cocky, and I don't want to in any way downplay Hart's, you know, moral failings, because, you know, he shouldn't have been doing what he was doing, right?
Well, it turns out he might not have been doing any of that. I mean, there's now a report came out, I don't know if you saw it, it was a couple of weeks ago, that the entire thing was a setup.
Oh, I dug into that. It's totally true. Lee Atwater.
Lee Atwater put it together, yeah.
Yeah, on behalf of George Bush,
right.
Because Bush did not want to run against Hart, the same reasons we're talking about. You know, what is if Hart's going to be running against, you know, release the JFK files, reopen the investigation, what's Bush going to do, say?
Yeah, this is the same way that Nixon took down Ed Muskie, I mean, because he didn't want to run against Muskie. Let's move along to John Nolan, this RFK aide who gave us so much information. Who is he? What did we learn from him? And B, why can we identify him now and we didn't before?
Well, and it's interesting, you know, hearing you say that name in public, you know, after all these, since the early 90s, when that was just a name, we would talk around this person.
That's right.
I think I called him in the books a close Kennedy aide or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So who was John Nolan? John Nolan was Robert Kennedy's top aide in 1963. John Nolan saw every single classified file that Robert Kennedy wrote or that Robert Kennedy saw. You know, when it came to the classified stuff, John Edward Nolan was the gatekeeper. He was a rising young attorney. He had helped deal with some Americans that were still in Castro's prison.
Right, and at this point in time, just for context, Robert Kennedy was not just John Kennedy's brother. He was the Attorney General of the United States. He was the chief law enforcement officer for the country.
And going after the mafia, he and John, like no one had ever done
Which
before.
Is why the mafia killed him. Which
exactly
is why the mafia
right.
killed Jack, anyway. And it looks like probably played a role in killing Bobby.
Exactly. And so this guy, John Edward Nolan, I mean, he was so close to Bobby. When plans were made, you know, for what to do with JFK's body, Nolan knew and told me, confirmed, and we've got files that prove it, you found one of them, that Robert Kennedy, for 2 months before the assassination, had been making plans for what to do if Castro found out about Robert Kennedy's plans to bring democracy to Cuba and somehow retaliated by assassinating an American official. That's why JFK's autopsy was not held in Texas, and that body was pretty much forcibly removed by the Secret Service, brought back, Bethesda Naval Hospital. Robert Kennedy was...
Hang on just a second here. You just slid past something really fast, and a lot of people might not have caught it.
Sure.
They were concerned that... And who was the guy who said, I'm in charge now?
Al Haig.
I remember, I believe, you know, I spent a lot of time in the JFK library, and I believe that I remember finding that document.
And
bringing it back.
Like, what does Al Haig have to do?
Right, and bringing it back to you, and then we were like, holy crap, what's going on here? So what had happened was that the Kennedy administration, in anticipation of, you know, because they were preparing to invade Cuba, concerned that if Castro discovered that there was actually going to be a serious, or not invade Cuba, rather, an assassination.
They were going to stage a coup using the number three man in Cuba, the head of the Cuban army, and the founder of the Cuban army.
Correct.
The guy that we only identified after he died.
Right, and this was the first week of December. It was going to happen 2 weeks after Kennedy was killed.
Ten days after Dallas.
So what they were afraid of was if Castro finds out about this, he might send a hitman to kill the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador or the U.S. ambassador to Mexico or something like that.
Right.
And if he successfully does that, once again, then the American people found out about it. Once again, the American people would demand that we take out Castro. And if we did that overtly, and this was a covert operation, if we did that overtly, that would bring in the Soviet Union and that would lead to World War III and tens of hundreds of millions of people would die all around the world. So what they put together, what Al Haig put together, signed off on, was this special thing that said, basically, if we believe that any of our American senior officials have been assassinated by a foreign power.
By Castro, basically.
Yeah, by Castro, basically. Yeah, it was a foreign power.
Then we will
basically mutilate the body, seize control of the body.
Well, let's be careful. So there are a lot of things, and again, we have a handful of pages of these, and 20 copies were made of each. The CIA worked on this, Robert Kennedy's people, the Secretary of the Army's people, that's how Al Haig comes into it. All these people were working on it, and we have a handful of pages, we should have hundreds, because they were meeting sometimes several times a week from September 63 until after JFK died. And so they were making these plans. So Nolan was the guy. Nolan saw every plan. He helped Robert write every memo about it. And he's the one who helped explain to me why this was being done and what was supposed to happen. Because as he said, let's say the U.S. ambassador to Panama looked like he had been assassinated. And a Cuban may have been involved. Well, we're going to have to invade Cuba, World War III, year after the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is not good. So the plans were designed to buy time so that you could make a reasoned thing. What if the ambassador was just killed by a jealous lover? Or just a random street robbery. You wouldn't want to have caused World War III because of that. So the whole thing of they're called the Cuba contingency plans were to buy time and also so that you would federalize, because you wouldn't want a Panamanian hospital doing that autopsy that could trigger World War III.
Or in this case, you wouldn't want a Texas hospital doing the autopsy.
I'm sorry, what?
And in the case of John Kennedy, you wouldn't want a Texas hospital doing the autopsy if you suspected that Kennedy had been assassinated by an agent of Castro.
Right, because Robert Kennedy was running this entire operation to basically have the number three man in Cuba eliminate, it was their word, Fidel and his brother Raul.
Yeah, this is Juan Almeida.
Juan Almeida, the founder of the Cuban army, and then he would invite in the assassinations of Castro and Raul, may as well call them what they would be, even though they call them eliminations, would be blamed on a Russian or a Russian sympathizer.
Right.
Who would be the
patsy, just like
Oswald.
Yeah.
And that would neutralize the 11,000 Russians still in Cuba, and then Commander Almeida, would invite U.S. forces in to prevent a Soviet takeover, and Robert Kennedy had overseen the training. We still have one confidential source left there we won't talk about, but the first U.S. troops into Cuba would not be a bunch of white crew-cut U.S. Marines. It would be a racially mixed group of Cuban army veterans, basically, and there would be a coalition government, and never, not the next year, not 10 years later, not 20 years later, no one would ever know that this was all basically a setup, that this was all planned from the start. Unfortunately, the mob godfathers, Trafficante and Marcello, Bobby was prosecuting and persecuting so heavily, deservedly so, they infiltrated this operation from which the mafia had been banned. The mafia was going to be banned from reopening their casinos if the coup succeeded. So they had nothing to gain by letting it go forward, but they knew how secret it was because several of their people were actually working on it. And so,
collaboratively with the CIA.
Right. Well, with several lower-level CIA people like Bernard Barker,
right.
was one. People afforded it. So bottom line is JFK is killed, and the mob uses, because they've infiltrated this super top secret plan that the public in America didn't know about until we wrote about it in our books, you know. Right. And we had to keep all this stuff secret for...
Oh, I was threatened by a one-star general in Washington, D.C., Harry's best friend. He threatened me with being put before a firing squad if I named Juan Almeida, because at the time he was still alive and he was still the number three guy in Cuba and he was still a U.S. asset.
And that's why we couldn't bring all this stuff out in the early 90s when we were getting it from Harry Williams and John Nolan and all these people. Because,
right. Yeah, in our first book, we couldn't name, as I recall, we didn't name Harry.
Well, we did name Harry. He was dead. Didn't name Almeida. It was only literally the day the hardback came out, completely separate from it.
Right.
The National Archives wrote and then told me by phone they were declassifying information identifying Juan Almeida's role. So then I took after taking an extra 2 years to write Ultimate Sacrifice so that no one would ever be able to figure out his identity.
Right, then you redid that. So we're talking now about John Nolan, because John Nolan has passed away, right?
Right. He died last year, and having lost my father back in March, you know, I didn't want to rush any of this. So it's been a year, and so Nolan knew Harry Williams. Nolan's knew Haynes Johnson, the noted journalist at the time. Nolan, obviously close to Robert Kennedy, remained close to Robert Kennedy, but... getting back to the day of the assassination, that night at Bethesda, per these plans that Nolan told me about, and we have pieces of, John Nolan was the intermediary between Robert Kennedy, who was several floors up with Jackie Kennedy, and the autopsy doctor. So John Nolan saw and helped to direct via JFK's personal physician, Admiral Berkeley, what happened at the autopsy, which is why Nolan was, as he told me, said, yes, 100% JFK was killed by a conspiracy. There was evidence at the autopsy that...
Hang on, would have
shown. You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to be back in just a minute. We'll recap exactly what John Nolan told us, what he learned as he was in the autopsy room with Jack Kennedy, and more. Stick around. So, Lamar, you want to, you know, that was all kind of being run together really fast in a jumble. You want to boil this back down again?
So, bottom line is, the U.S. was about to overthrow Castro 10 days before Dallas. They had been making plans for what to do if Castro found out and retaliated. John Nolan, Robert Kennedy's closest aide, was part of that planning. So, of course, JFK's body is brought back to Bethesda Naval Hospital in Washington. And while Robert Kennedy is on, I believe it was this fifth, sixth, seventh floor, something like that, with Jackie Kennedy, he's on the phone with John Nolan. I even found exactly which phone. And then Nolan would relay Bobby's instructions about what to do and what not to do to Admiral Berkeley, who was JFK, the White House personal physician, who would then basically, you know, give the orders to the admirals and officers conducting the autopsy. What most people don't realize, there was what some people call a national security autopsy, a very brief one, right before the official autopsy. That's when a bullet was found by a guy who later became a rear admiral. He was one of incredible people here. That's when the tiny throat wound that had been opened to a very small tracheotomy opening in Dallas was hugely enlarged. So there was a very rushed, very small, very quick national security autopsy before the official autopsy began. So Nolan, you know, was part of that. That left him convinced, and no doubt Robert Kennedy convinced, there was a conspiracy had killed JFK.
Because the bullets had come from multiple directions.
Right. And that you can't fire bullets in two different opposite directions. And so Robert Kennedy, John Nolan was the first of several people that Robert Kennedy said, look, I want you to do your own unofficial investigation. You know, the Warren Commission's doing their thing. Hoover, I don't really trust. And you know, we all trying to prevent World War III, so I can't be public on this. But so Nolan actually did his own private investigation. And he continued, and he also worked with Bobby on some of Bobby's other private investigations. and remained close to Bobby, literally, you know, through Bobby's final campaign. Yeah, I think they saw each other, you know, within days of, you know, Robert Kennedy dying, if not that day. And so John Nolan continued to carry that torch, you know, through the church committee in the 70s, through the House Select Committee in the late 70s.
The torch being that he knew it was a conspiracy because he had been there in the room and he could see that this body had been shot from two different directions.
Exactly, exactly. And also, because he had access to all the top intelligence that Robert Kennedy had, he knew eventually that Castro didn't do it. So, and he told me, yeah, Castro didn't do this. And so he knew for a long time that it was Carlos Marcello, godfather of Louisiana and much of Texas, and Santo Trafficante, godfather of much of Florida, especially Tampa, had been behind it, because, you know, they almost killed JFK in Tampa 4 days before Dallas. Bobby and John F. Kennedy had to cover that up, keep it out of the press at the time. John Nolan had a...
Yeah, we found that story in the newspaper archive, in the microfilm archives, in that god-awful newspaper down...
Look through thousands of pages, found the one article that came out the day after JFK died. The next day, when people tried to follow up, reporters, it was like clammed up. Nobody talked about it. But so Nolan did get one more piece that I guess we'll talk about. We'll wrap up after the break.
We will do that. We will do that. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. His latest book is The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. He's also the author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, and books that I played a role in. We'll be right back. It's a once-in-a-lifetime luxury Alaskan cruise on the Regent Seven Seas Mariner, July 24, 2019. For more information, Keen Luxury Travel, 800-856-1155. And did I mention, we'll be getting active on board with special events with yours truly, me, and Louise, as we visit Ketchikan, Juneau, Skagway, Sitka, Hubbard Glacier, and Anchorage. 55. Welcome back. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. His most recent book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. The website, thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com. And Lamar, we were talking about John Nolan, the guy who was our informant, who was Bobby Kennedy's right-hand man, who was in the autopsy room as they were doing the autopsy with Bobby while he was, on John in Bethesda, while Bobby was up on the sixth or seventh floor with Jackie. And Bobby was continuously on the phone with Nolan. And very early on, when they did the national security autopsy, a very short autopsy before the major autopsy, it was obvious to everybody at that point that John Kennedy's body had been shot by bullets coming from two different directions. Everybody in the room realized it was a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. And John Nolan told us that. John Nolan conveyed that to Bobby Kennedy. You want to recap how that got responded to? We've got just a couple minutes till the end of the show.
Well, and again, there were Nolan's and several other secret investigations involved there. The piece that Nolan was always missing until the 70s was, you know, they knew where Trafficante was. Marcello was in a courtroom being prosecuted by you know, Bobby's own prosecutor that I also talked, you know, so...
At the time of the assassination, yeah.
Right, you know, and we knew that Trafficante... So somebody else had to be there, probably even a level higher than Michael Victor Mertz. And again, Nolan would have seen that Mertz memo. And so,
by be there, you mean on the ground in Dallas, a supervisor participating in the assassination.
Some experienced assassin there who could do that. So what happened in the 70s that we didn't mention, and I'll just say briefly... So the church committee had a big problem. Like the House Select Committee, the key witnesses kept dying. Sam Giancana, Chicago mob boss, died before he could testify.
Yeah, Johnny Roselli.
Jimmy Hoffa died next. And then Johnny Roselli, the Chicago Mafia's man in Hollywood and Vegas, who also dealt with Trafficante and Marcello. And he was brutally murdered, went up 55-gallon oil drum. So he was the missing piece. That Nolan needs. So when Nolan told me, when I asked him, okay, so who was behind it? He said it was Marcello, Trafficante, and Johnny Roselli. It was those three, and he was as certain as of that as it's, you know, the sun is going to rise tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
And so, but he explained so much more too. He said, you know, why they had to keep Tampa secret. He said because of all the national security to prevent World War III, Robert Kennedy couldn't even help Abraham Bolden, the framed Secret Service agent.
He's been on this show.
Yeah. Right, who was arrested the day he went to Washington to tell the Warren Commission staff about the attempt to kill JFK in Tampa 4 days before Dallas, and in Chicago 3 weeks before Dallas. So again, you know, can't thank John Nolan enough. John Nolan, when I spoke to him, was a partner in the most powerful law firm in all of Washington, D.C. It may still be. And it was some other time we'll talk. I mean, it was the weirdest interview I've ever had. But he, you know, he was a stand-up guy because he was like, look, you know, and he said, look, anything Harry Williams told you, you can go to the bank on. You know, he named one of our other confidential sources who's still confidential. And he just confirmed. He said, yeah, you know, it worked. And, you know, number three guy. And so he just confirmed and gave us so much information, and we appreciate that, and that's why we kept his name secret.
Yeah, and you can read all about it if you want to read all three of the books, actually. Ultimate Sacrifice was the first that we wrote together, Legacy of Secrecy the second, and then Lamar just came out with a new book, The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. Lamar Waldron, Waldron, you can check it out. Lamar, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Good
always
talking
a pleasure.
To you. Yeah, back at you. And happy Thanksgiving. We'll be right back.
To you and the family.
Now, that was an hour of Tom Hartman. I hope you got something out of that. And we are going to do NPR News just after a little bit of music. And then Dan Ruth is here, set to give you an hour of call in, guys, because we really want to talk today about what's going on in the world. This is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 on the left side of your dial. Best little radio station on planet Earth. Stay tuned for NPR News and then Daniel Ruth.